Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this webinar focusing on the journal around telehealth and telemedicine. We have two distinguished guests with us today that will help us explore more deeply the intersection of innovation, evidence, and credibility in digital health. And we're seeing an unprecedented wave of ideas and enterprise solutions, but often many of them don't get to the wide public, and when they do, they're not always validated correctly. And so the effort of the journal, of course, is to really bring some insight into these. So to do so, we have two panelists. I'm going to ask each of them to briefly introduce themselves, and then I'll ask questions, and hopefully we'll have a good lively debate. So Hill, do you want to kick off and tell us a bit about your background and your role in the journal?
Thank you, Paul, and good morning, Martin, as well, and Tori. I'm an orthopedic surgeon based in London. I've been here for actually almost three decades in different sectors of orthopedics. Beyond orthopedics, my other domain has been digital health. And starting from telehealth now for the last 3-4 years into artificial intelligence, the generative artificial intelligence into healthcare merger. My interest is to bring a technology into healthcare and to solve the problems, not only workflow, but the quality and the audit and the governance problems as well. My intention has been translated into several software I designed, and I continue to do so through different teams of telehealth and healthcare AI technical software development teams. I want to learn more from Martin is here, and I really want to hear more from him as well. Thank you, Paul.
So thank you, Martin.
Great. Well, hello, everybody, and good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. And it's terrific to be here with you today, Paul and Sahil, and also Tori, who's the publisher of Telehealth and Medicine Today. I'm an electronic engineer. I spent 30 years in industry with companies like Philips, GE, Intel, and MasterCard. I spent 5 years as CIO and then head of digital transformation in the Irish Health Service. And I'm really thrilled to have joined Telehealth and Medicine Today as a co-editor in chief. And I think this is a really exciting time in the world of health and medicine. And as Paul mentioned, we're seeing unprecedented levels of innovation. And I'm currently a professor of innovation and digital health at Maynooth University in Ireland. I lead a global digital health ecosystem. Innovation is most powerful when it takes place in the context of a vision. And what I hope to bring to Telehealth and Medicine Today, which I think is a really excellent journal, and I explain why in a second, is trying to bring some alignment. So we have all this amazing innovation and research happening around the world. But I want to try and help shape and what we call guide it into a particular direction, which is going to shift healthcare from orbiting around hospitals and consultants to orbiting around us as individuals, our homes, and our phones. And personally, I think the mobile phone will be the most important medical instrument of the 21st century. And I call that paradigm stay left, shift left, 10x. And let me explain it very briefly. Stay left is about keeping people well in the first instance, or if you have a chronic disease or need rehab, we can do that best of all from home. It's also about early detection and some of the digital health diagnostics, which have already been described in Telehealth and Medicine Today, are now allowing GPs in their surgeries or even individuals in their home diagnose conditions that previously required maybe a year waiting list and diagnosis in acute hospital. So we're going to see a number of what we call Copernican shifts from illness to wellness, from hospital to home, from analog to digital. Very importantly, a shift from paternalism to partnership. And many years ago, Warner Slack, who was one of the pioneers of electronic health records, he said the patient is the most underutilized resource in healthcare. And that's a real opportunity. And why I think researchers and innovators should be interested in publishing in Telehealth and Medicine Today. Well, first, the clue is in the title today. This is a journal that is current. When I was at Intel, I was kind of a bit shocked to see some of the top journals in innovation. They were about 2 or 3 years behind, actually, even longer behind the pace of industry. I think one of the key ambitions for telehealth and medicine today is to be really current, publishing what's actually happening in the field today. And this is an incredibly fast-moving field. And one of the key research paradigms that we're adopting as part of the editorial team is the concept of design science research. And design science research is problem-oriented. At its core, it's about research, rigor, and relevance. And it's about constructing artifacts that are iteratively tested and add value. But it's also, I know this is a topic that Sohail is really interested in. It's about adoption. What we're particularly interested in is helping getting novel innovations adopted broadly. And, you know, many of you listening will have heard about pilotitis. It is a particular condition that many health innovators experience when they have a novel innovation that gets adopted in one place, but it's very difficult to get broadly adopted due to what actually probably Wes Streeting, who's the health secretary in the UK, he talks about a culture of the computer, says no. So we're particularly interested in publications that are about how you get your solutions adopted or new digital health solutions that are being broadly adopted. And we will be using the term design pattern. Design pattern is a generally reusable solution to a commonly recurring problem. And essentially, it designs 80% of the core solution and then might allow a health system or a hospital or a network of GP surgeries then to customize the 20% to their solution. So we're in a really fast-moving field, and actually the rate of adoption can really save lives or extend lives. So we're especially keen to hear about innovations that are being adopted, but also bring exponential benefits. Because my realization when I became the CIO of the Irish Health Service is that incremental innovations aren't enough because the demands are compounding. We all know the demographics. Our hospitals are full. They're very expensive. And if we could do something, for example, in a GP surgery in the home, it's typically 10 times cheaper. And these kinds of solutions will actually put healthcare on a much more sustainable footing with benefits for patients, but also for clinicians. So I'll hand back to you, Paul,
you,
there.
Thank you. And that was lovely. I'm trying to keep this a little bit shorter so we can have a good back and forward, but this is a good preamble. And so my challenge to both of you is, and I'll start with Sohail. So, you know, digital health is full of solutions that seem to work, at least according to the companies that advertise, but often they're not proven that they actually work, and certainly not in real world conditions. We see lots of great pilots and strong internal data, compelling stories, but we rarely see independent peer-reviewed validation. So are we building just products, or are we actually building evidence-based solutions? And what is the role of telehealth and medicine today, and your role as editor to help help us better get to solutions that actually work under real world conditions?
Thank you, Paul. I'd love to take this question. Yes, I think the important point here is to differentiate telehealth and medicine today from other journals which are available online. Like, it's a very domain-specific focus. It is the way we virtualize medicine, and that is the focus. It's a very domain-specific focus. At the same time, it brings a lot of clinical expertise, because the people who are writing in it, they're all, most of them would be experienced clinicians touching the patient care almost day on, day out basis. So it's very topical. There's a high topical relevance, and there's a high clinical and technological integration. So a person who is discussing an idea is involved in patient care. So the idea can go to a very high-tech idea, and of course he or she can take support of the engineers. But at the same time, the idea brought to the viewership And the viewership is the clinical viewership, people who are doing patient care. So they can challenge the idea positively, and they can also give further thoughts that this could be done better this way. I was just reviewing another an article from India about the hyperbaric oxygen and telemedicine. And that is a fascinating idea that you can increase the diameter of activity and the focus perimeter by using a simple telemedicine in hyperbaric chamber review. So the therapy review can be extended by simple means of technology, which means the hyperbaric medicine treatment can be available to people who cannot have access. So this gives this just provokes thought process. It elevates the level of care. And that is why I suppose people who publish with us, they should come with an idea that they will be challenged. They will be challenged by those who are involved in patient care but don't have the expertise to technology as much as other people have. So that is a great combination. People who don't practice technology and people who practice technology with medicine, and they're meeting at the junction of THMT. I love this thought, and I feel this is the way I was pulled in by Torio into this journal, that how can people think about, people don't use technology at all. When they hear about this being done through technology, what do they think? That excites me. I hope this answers your question, Paul.
It does. So, I mean, Martin, one of the biggest challenges often is that people do the work and then they think about publishing it, versus traditionally in research-driven as opposed to enterprise-driven, you plan the research before you start the work. So really, this is a question, given your background in industry, how do you get industry to think differently about the role of the rigor required to actually design the work early enough with the correct research hooks, so it's not retrofitted, but it's actually designed to demonstrate meaningful impact on real users under real-world conditions?
It's a great question, Paul. Maybe I'll answer it sort of in two different ways. And one of the things is the editorial team, we're thinking more and more about this idea of design science research as a research paradigm. And there's a whole methodology associated with that that actually involves rapid iteration. And I think by framing, and there's a continuum between research and innovation. And I think design science research is in the sweet spot there. But I'm just thinking about the current issue of telehealth and medicine today. And what I really like about is the different kinds of research and innovation that are being published. So, for example, in the current edition, there's an original clinical research, which is about a modern informatic-based system for telemedicine adoption and adherence in a real-life study, and that's by Stefano Palazzo and colleagues. And that kind of addresses, some of the issues that, in your question there, for example, and what Suhail mentioned, the focus on adoption, but also creating the empirical evidence from the field. There's a beautiful paper which is in the section on use cases and pilots, cost-effective IoT-based real-time vital sign monitoring and affordable telehealth solutions. And this is, we know that 50% of the world doesn't have access to affordable care. And what this paper by Krishna Priya and Prima proposes is a solution which effectively creates a low-cost digital twin, which is another important trend in health. And they publish the exact architecture of that and how it's being used. But then we have something that's probably more scholarly, which is a meta-analysis, and that's from El Quarti and colleagues. The assessment criteria of digital health interventions focusing on health care providers, a scoping review. And this kind of research is written by doctors for doctors, and I think it's very useful. And then just one other one that caught my eye, I was recently in Indonesia giving some talks at several of the universities in Jakarta and Bandung, and I just saw this amazing opportunity in Indonesia. 300 million people and the opportunity for Indonesia to adopt telehealth so that it can leap ahead. And there's a lovely market research analysis by Sediwati and colleagues, Beyond Technology, Social Support Risk and Economic Value in Physicians Telemedicine Adoption in Indonesia. So this isn't just a journal that's kind of for mainland US or Western Europe. It's actually getting papers from all over the world. And ultimately, you know, the synthesis of all of these, you know, pieces of content, some that are more market oriented and some that are deeply scholarly, it's really going to make a contribution to moving the entire discipline and associated industry forward. So I think it's very exciting, Paul.
So, Martin, you know, if we're going to position ourselves to be a bridge between industry and academia, that's a conversation that really forces honesty. It addresses the gaps and it applies to everybody. The question is the market interested? I mean, does it actually help them ultimately gain credibility? Does it help them gain new partnerships? And what can we in the journal do to help elevate that discourse so that, you know, industrial partners that are building solutions actually reach to us in order to get the imprimatur of a peer review platform?
A great question, Paul. And the intersection between academia and industry, it's kind of like a fault line. It can be an uncomfortable place to be, but it's absolutely essential. And you're going back to what Sahil had increasingly, as you know, be it a very large producer like a Siemens or a Philips or a GE, or you know, what digital is increasingly doing is democratizing innovation. So now one clinician, one patient can develop an innovation that will change the world. And I think we're going to be expecting some really nice submissions, you know, over the next 6 to 9 months from people that have done that. But the process of adoption is really about meeting three criteria. And this is where the multidisciplinary approach, obviously you need clinical efficacy, you need the technical efficacy, and then business efficacy. So it's no use having an amazing clinical breakthrough if it's not affordable or it's not scalable. And what we're working through, you know, the systems innovation methodology that the European Commission, Intel, and Maynooth University developed with lots of other partners, a core instrument there is the idea of a health living lab. So this is a structured methodology for actually bringing digital health innovations to the market. And I think one of the contributions that THMT could make is similarly to, you know, the very regulated structured process for discovering and bringing a new drug to market with clinical trials. I think we could put a structured methodology that's actually a lot less complex for bringing these digital health innovations to the marketing and proving their efficacy. And I think many, many digital health entrepreneurs, and whether that's a very large company or a smaller company, they really have a thirst. They want to be able to show, you know, peer-reviewed empirical evidence that their product just doesn't work on the bench. It works, you know, bedside. So I think, and I, you know, we actually have a very ambitious publisher, Tori Sinaj, who's on the call here. And through our collective efforts, you know, Sahil mentioned this is an evolutionary maturity journey. You know, in my, you know, experience, overnight success takes on average a decade. So we're kind of, I think, about 3 or 4 years away from really hitting that critical mass where actually people are looking to THMT as the place to publish in digital health. But I'm very confident if we just keep executing, this is going to be the place to publish, you know, 2 to 3, 4 years.
Thank you, Martin. So I guess, you know, you as a clinician, entrepreneur who sits in multiple sides of this question, here's a question that I always often ask executives. So would you rather move fast with an innovation that's not validated or slow it down so you actually work out the kinks with publishable evidence? And would the market actually reward you if you slow down in order to design a product that's more likely to have lasting impact?
Well, this is an interesting and rather difficult question to ask. People who are driven by dopamine based on motivation, innovation, though you can't stop them. They have to bring some crazy ideas in the world. I actually give you an example, a paper published in THMT about the image-based operating room management. Now that is a kind of a way out of the book idea that how the images in from the OR, from the operating room, can suggest what's going on, the video analysis. Now, to me, it seems like crazy, but we can find out something. If there's somebody sitting there who's reading our paper, our journal, he can say, "Look, I can try this and I find value and I see what you don't see." So there's always a room for mistake in innovation, over enthusiastic step. But there is a corner in innovation which is hidden by many, except few. I believe in that. So the answer to your question is that yes and no. Yes, because people who are driven by this, they only have this energy. If you say, look, you have to have a validation, a strict peer-to-peer validation before you publish, they will not grow. They will not grow. The guy who designed a software called Waze, which was sold out to Google for
Yes.
$1 billion some 10
Yes.
years back, he said something very useful here. He said, if you try and bring a feature-full product, it is likely to fail. But if you try and solve a problem, it is likely to succeed. So we can always invite authors who are trying to solve a problem. At the same time, you can keep a small mix of those people who are trying to bring attention to certain things which have not been practiced. They are trying to show a new way. I believe in both. If we are only trying to solve a problem, we cannot leap towards faster speed. We cannot go to quantum. I mean, to be honest, we don't need quantum physics. We don't need quantum computing. Our job is being done well, but we are doing it for the sake of curiosity. So I think there should be a room for crazy innovation. At the same time, they should be focused on solving a problem. So I would go, I mean, I may disagree with you, Paul, respectfully. And I
Well, no.
love your love discussing this with you. Innovation can go sometimes very absurd. But
Well,
some guy couldn't
the
find a
reality is
taxi, he buys an
that
Uber.
I would love for more of the startups that I see that you've seen work. The reality is that if they don't reduce costs, if they don't improve outcomes, if they don't increase revenue, no one's going to buy them. And so the fact that it's cool and has AI and has a patient app is nice. But the mission critical pain point has to be extraordinarily clear. Otherwise, it's dead on arrival. So, my question to you, Martin, is, I mean, is one of the goals of the journal to help the field mature in a way that it can actually slow down the process, ironically, in order for more mature thinking and prototyping building before these companies fall short? So, what is the role of the journal in helping to shape that discussion and helping the ecosystem of health system innovation mature?
Again, a really good question. And this discipline of medicine has been around actually probably since the time of William Harvey and Copernicus in the University of Padua, the cradle of modern medicine. But the discipline of innovation is far less mature. And I like Larry Keeley is he works for Dublin in Chicago, and what he said recently, at a global Intel innovation conference that I organized, he said, we're now just about at the threshold moment where we're starting to see the inner workings and the secrets of innovation. And what is emerging is the key patterns for successful innovation. And I think you mentioned earlier, the average success rate of innovations is about 6%. And I think one of the key things we can do through the journal is introduce the new practices and this emerging discipline of innovation, which leads to more predictable, more probable, and more profitable innovation. And this methodology of health living labs, where we actually combine both the characteristics of agility and speed, or actually I prefer to say velocity, and building the empirical evidence. And health living labs are emerging as a methodology for introducing radical innovation in a managed, non-threatening way. So you typically start with a concept and then you do the first patient, and that's typically a clinician and a patient working together. And if that's not successful, you stop. Hopefully you don't kill the patient. And then you go to a proof of concept, which is typically 10 patients, a couple more clinicians, and you're all the time, you're collecting evidence, agile, iterating, you're using a design thinking process of getting inputs from the clinicians, the administrators, the patient. If that's successful, then you go to what we call a demonstrator, 100 to 500 patients. All the time you're looking at the clinical, technical efficacy in the business case. And then you come to a stage gate and you actually make a decision, then do we broadly deploy this? And this is the way many modern corporations develop their products, whether you're a Google or an Intel. It's a process of innovation pipeline management, and taking that process and moving it into the medical sphere, and very much like the pharmaceutical industry, there's a very well tried and tested process for, you know, exploring and testing new drugs. We need to bring that process and practice into the digital health sphere. And digital health is way less mature and it needs some leadership. And I think one of the roles of the journal is to help spread the word and diffuse the knowledge and try to get to a systematic methodology for your rapid control testing that leads empirical evidence. And just to make one other point, we talk about the quintuple aim. And what we have to do, in fact, I think the biggest issue for digital health adoption is not whether it adds a lot of value. It is the cognitive load on clinicians, and particularly, for example, nurses, extremely task saturated. So in Open Innovation 2.0, we talk about designing for adoption. So if a solution only adds, you know, 5% of value or 10% value, it's not going to get adopted. But if a solution is 10 times easier to use, is 10 times faster, or removes, you know, 10x of the cognitive load from a clinician or indeed a patient, it gets rapidly adopted. So we like to think about the quintuple aim: better care and outcomes, lower cost or higher value, better patient experience and quality of life, better clinician experience, quality of life, and indeed productivity. And then finally, sustainability, both from an environmental standpoint and also financial sustainability. So take, for example, your one area where there's been a fair bit of innovation is in capsule endoscopy. And this now allows, instead of one consultant doing a physical colonoscopy, maybe 10 or 100 people actually could swallow a pill camera. And that's all done in parallel. We can use AI to interpret those results and then have the consultant look at them. But this hits every area of the quintuple aim. It's equivalent care. It's much lower cost. It's a better patient experience. They don't have to.
I agree. But that doesn't address the problem, you know, and I'm a big fan of Alan Cooper. And Alan Cooper wrote this fantastic book, The Inmates Are Running the Asylum. He wrote that 20 years ago. I think it's 10 times worse. I think a lot of healthcare startups are designed around engineers who design them, but there's limited and non-continuous user experience professionals and users. And so often the innovation itself is plausible, but the adoption and the trust in the process, because it doesn't capture real workflow, it doesn't respect usability and human factors, it doesn't really understand how to do proper usability, in fact, as opposed to hardware.
Yes. The one thing I'd say, look, I think there is evidence, but it doesn't sort of, you know, get to the level of the gold standard that you as a practicing physician would need. And one of the key things that I think is critically important, and you've mentioned it several times, is human factors and user innovation. The role of the patient has changed from being a research object to now being part of the innovation process. And design thinking is an incredibly important part of a new product development. And I agree what needs to happen is, and different people can, you'll design these new innovations. And I agree something can look wonderful on a bench, but when it collides with your real world, it falls apart. So doing design thinking upfront, using, having the clinicians involved, having patients involved, having administrators involved, having the payer involved is really important. So you're actually designing for success from the get-go. And the other aspect that I think is hugely important, and I want to read a quote from Lou Gerstner. He said, "I came to see in my time at IBM that culture isn't just one aspect of the game. It is the game. And what I see the highest sort of rate of failure in healthcare systems for new innovations isn't about the technical, the business case, or the clinical efficacy. It's about the culture that is absorbing these innovations." And
I would agree. I would agree. And so really what we're arguing is that, well, innovation, if you will, is on the easier, solvable issue. The adoption is all about the incentives, the trust, the social cultural attributes that are part of building tools that have not just technical affordances, but social technical affordances.
I think you've nailed it, because this is a socio-technical problem. And if we think about the broader, digital transformation of the health industry, that's not only possible, but essential. The way I like to talk about it is a sequence of deep, cohesive technology, process, and cultural shifts. And if any one of those fails, and very often culture is the problem, we have to think about the way healthcare systems are designed. They are hierarchical. They are command and control. And actually, the conditions we need for innovation are exactly.
Yeah, but how do you do that when you have misaligned incentives around the patient, the provider, and the payers, right? So startups will think about one but not the other. Patients might love it, but nobody's going to pay for it. Or it might be good for the system, but it adds more cognitive workload for the providers. So how do you implement, and how does the journal really signal that we want real world products that actually support the entire ecosystem of stakeholders?
No, that's true. And I know Suhail has had to drop off, and he would have had an opinion on this. I recently had a paper published in the British Medical Journal Leader, and it's proposing a new theory of the business for our health, which we call stay left, shift left, 10X. And one of the key assumptions, is that our current healthcare, the theory of the business is broken and the business model is broken. So the US is spending 20% of its GDP on healthcare. In the UK, 40% of day-to-day government spending is on health, and that's getting unsustainable. So we actually need to completely reimagine and create a new theory of the business for health and the associated business model. And we have to think about, the patient, we have to think about the payers, we have to think about the clinicians. And for these solutions to be adopted, they have to hit all five areas of the quintuple aim, and increasingly sustainability is a really important driver.
Maybe what we need is that we have to frame evidence in the journal as a way to cross the chasm in healthcare, if you will. The journal becomes a bridge for startups and others to move from innovation teams to mainstream risk-averse health systems. And so we're really about building long-term credibility for starting innovations.
I think that's exactly the point. And, Crossing the Chasm by Geoffrey Moore, it's a wonderful book, recommend to all our listeners. And of course, that was built on some seminal work by Everett Rogers, kind of a decade earlier. One of the key things that Geoffrey Moore talks about is the full product. And this example I talked about earlier, Dr. Roisin Molloy, in bringing her thermometer to the market, she actually used Moore's thinking. So not only did she have, you know, the full training, but she also had an ROI calculator. So a hospital CEO in 3 or 4 minutes could actually immediately look at that product and see what the financial return to his hospital could be in terms of, you know, the number of nursing FTEs that could be eliminated, the cost of the caps, the lower cost of maintenance. So, Paul, I think the journal can play a really important role in actually educating innovators in terms of, well, what does it take to cross the chasm? And it's not just a business imperative and a moral imperative, because a lot of these innovations, they save lives or extend lives. And I think that's a great suggestion that you've just made.
Well, I mean, at the end, as we think about the last few minutes here, I mean, it seems to me, and as somebody who lives both in the business world, but as a practicing clinician that advises startups and enterprise workers and companies, that we're applying principles from Silicon Valley playbooks, if you will, to a system that requires real-world evidence, aligned incentives, and deep trust, something that we rarely have for typical Silicon Valley players. And that might be the key reason why many healthcare startups fail. Would you agree?
I do. And, you know, one of the things that I try to bring, having been sort of in Silicon Valley for 25 years, and for example, I use the word 10X, which is just common part of the vocabulary in Silicon Valley, but not used much elsewhere. So there's so much that we can learn there. But I also like to talk about high trust, high capability relationships. And that's, you know, very much essential. So there's kind of, you know, an uncontested space in terms of amongst the journals to actually be, you know, help the entire industry cross the chasm, because you've mentioned, and we've talked about, the high failure rate. And I think there's a role for the journal to both educate and be a conduit and show those lighthouse examples how to successfully bring digital health innovations.
And as well as not to hide from failures. You know, in Silicon Valley, they have this notion of, you know, fail often, fail quickly, and learn from it. And, you know, Tori is very keen on publishing failed studies. We're not getting enough of that, even though we've asked for that for a while ago. And so the question really is how do we get the community to understand that there's deep value in studying the failures, as well as, and in some ways, more than studying the successes?
You know, totally. And, you know, as a professor and teaching, I know, you know, students, you know, they maybe remember 10% of what you tell them, maybe 30% of what they actually do hands-on. But the greatest learnings come from the failures. And I know in my own career, it's been those tough failures where I've had the greatest learnings. So, well, I'm not going to do that again.
So as we tie this all together, as we think about, you know, the lean thinking, you know, we haven't really talked about Clay Christensen, but he's here about the misaligned incentive. So how do we learn from this early traction that Moore describes, and how do we bring it all together as a journal where success isn't just about building faster, it's about proving that it works and proving that it works under different conditions? And how do we best turn it into an invitation for getting published, so that it helps the company and the ecosystem understand the innovation challenges and the rare successes that come from this pipeline of innovation and inspiring ideas?
No, very good. I'm a, you know, huge fan of the late Clay Christensen. I had the privilege of taking a class with him once, and such a, you know, there's something we can learn from people like Clay, as well as, you know, his amazing works, The Innovator's Dilemma. His humility was something that was just the joy to behold. So I think the journal can really sort of coexist at the nexus of a few different things. It can exist. Clearly, it's about medicine, it's about telehealth, but also there's a nexus there with innovation and entrepreneurship and management. And that is, you know, thinking about you, some of you might know the, or some of our listeners might know the INSEAD book around red ocean, blue ocean. And there's an uncontested space for a journal that actually addresses all of these factors. And it's only when all of these factors are successfully addressed do these innovations cross the chasm and get broadly adopted. And I like to talk about the five P's, about purpose, people, progress, passion, and then profit. And, you know, if an entrepreneur, be that a clinician, a patient, or an engineer, can align around those, then you're well on the way to actually having accessible innovation. So I think, you know, this is a journal that's on an emergence journey and is, you know, iterating and changing. And, you know, the editorial team is being strengthened. And, you know, I think the North Star should be to be the journal, the go-to journal for entrepreneurs, be that a clinician, a patient, a large corporation that actually want to change health outcomes and lifespan and health span. And the best practice, and indeed the best practice, is contained in this journal.
Martin, thank you. And Sohail, for that, as we wrap up, I want to just leave us and our audience with one idea. Clearly, digital health is no longer just judged by innovation. It has to be judged by evidence and credibility and ultimately impact. We've talked about, you know, why so many promising solutions struggle to scale, often not because they don't work, but because they haven't really been proven. In a way that healthcare systems can use, can incorporate in their workflow, as well as getting the providers to trust. I'm reminded that many, many clinicians do not use telehealth these days, even though it's available, because something is missing, and that missing is that face-to-face contact, which often companies don't always appreciate. So I think there's a shift here, and that means we have to ask different questions. Where is the evidence? Is it reproducible? Has it been independently validated? And I think that's where THMT, telehealth and telemedicine today, needs to find. And that space is about trust, trust that's built on proof, not just potential and aspirational ideas. And so the opportunity for us is in the journal is to build evidence-backed solutions and stepping stones, moving from pilots to outcomes, and ultimately moving from innovation to scale impact. And you know, so the question really is not does the product work, but can you prove it in a way that patients, consumers, and providers will trust and be able to use it? So not, you know, not someday, but you know, in a realistic future. And that's why people will validate, publish in our journal, and stand behind their outcomes. So, thank you so much, Martin and Sohail, and for a fascinating conversation. And I think we're on a precipice of exciting future for the journal, and I look forward to our close collaboration. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. A pleasure.